As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to episode 31 of The Ruck from this season. I'm Alex Lowe and I'm joined down the line today by Stephen Jones, whose journey into London was stymied by the same train nightmares that that made life pretty tricky for Liverpool and Man City fans on Saturday, and by Stuart Barnes. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Great pleasure for you.
Pleasure.
Great pleasure for me indeed. How were your Easter weekends? What sporting treats and sweet delights did you experience?
Well, I saw a game which I think at the Stoop, which I think the Harlequins crowd were probably one of the noisiest they've ever been. I just took me back because I'm so old. When I first started watching Harlequins, Alex, they played inside a running track, and they were always about about 300 yards away from the single stand. But by me, they got some fans over the years. There was a tremendous atmosphere, a dramatic game, and in the end, all hinging on a conversion which any of us three would have put over.
Yeah.
So something to write about, that was.
Incredible. Stuart, what did you enjoy?
I would love to see Steve in the 875th minute. Any minute, lining that one up. It wasn't in front of the post. It was on the 15-metre line. It's a 9 out of 10 kick. He should have got it. Of course he should. But it wasn't quite that straightforward. Pressure does weird things to you. As for me, I had no pressure. I had a nice, easy drive to the East Midlands, where Leicester had a nice, easy win against Clermont. Clermont didn't field their strongest team. And Leicester, in true Steve Borthwick fashion, did what they had to do and not a lot more. It was impressive in a sort of third gear way, which is how I think Leicester like to play. It'll be really interesting to see when they have to go, you know, top gear all the way against Leinster, what happens. But they're motoring along nicely at the moment.
Speaking just of one thing about on that note. When I was at Oxford Poly, I was the goal kicker. And I kicked a goal from the touchline in the Oxford Bonn versus Bonn Twin Towns match at the Gronau Stadium in Bonn to win the match. So before you rubbish my goal kicking, I could kick the odd goal.
I retract, Steve. That was
okay. Apology accepted. Apology accepted.
So were you the... What position did you play, Steve? Second row?
Number eight.
In number eight and goal kicker.
We were so many points behind. We then drove the ball on at the scrum. I touched down, and then I took the conversion. So what more could I do for the team? I then, in the next play, threw a horrible pass, which was intercepted, and they scored under the post.
Brilliant. Well, great times. Talking of loud crowds, I was at Wembley yesterday, took my son, who's a Crystal Palace fan, and the noise that those Palace fans made for 90 minutes, their team was losing, was just wonderful. And it's one of those, I think, it sounds like you had the same at the Stoop, when, you know, when a crowd has its passion kind of flowing down from the stands. It's just something remarkable in sport that you get. And I had a great experience of that. And actually, I was at Bristol Friday night for a madcap game, and, you know, by the end, that big crowd at Ashton Gate was not dissimilar. They were up on their feet, roaring as Bristol almost came back from nowhere against 14 and sometimes 13 men against against Sale, and then just fell short. And it was a great entertaining game, which triggered a pretty memorable weekend of European rugby in the Champions Cup and in the Challenge, all of which we'll examine in detail coming up on the Ruck. We'll go back through all of the Champions Cup fixtures. We will reflect on the latest in the Women's Six Nations, and we will finish with our weekly God, Goddess or Devil Award. Let's start with the Champions Cup. As we said, we're all at different games. Stuart, what was your general reflection on this round of 16, the two legs, which is a new feature this season, but it threw up some cracking ties. There's a lot of talk about this home and away system staying. The problem is, how many weekends can you free up to have home and away games? But blimey, it created some drama, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the home and away, it was absolutely brilliant this weekend. I mean, bear in mind, it was a one-off. We don't know what would happen if we did it for the next 10 years. But on the evidence of this, it was highly exciting. It galvanised a tournament that has been slumbering, not for its own fault either, because mainly COVID. But as you say, we got the extra game because we were losing pool matches. When we're not losing pool matches, we can't have the extra game. God bless these players. They're playing way too much as it is. I would love to see the group of 16 stay, because I think it was an unquestionable success. And as an experiment, it's worth being maintained for a few years to check if it stays like that. But that means that Europe has to get its head together with France, the Celtic nations, England, and work out how the hell we can get this extra game in. I haven't thought about the minutiae of that yet, but it's worth a ponder, I think.
Steve, you've been quite down on the...
I totally agree. I mean, we've got to keep this home and away round. 16 teams in both competitions, 8 fixtures per week. I just think we have to keep it. If you do, the only trouble is then you have to have fewer pool games. You'd have to have 8 pools of 3 or something like that. But do you know what I'd be really confident about the future if there was any debate about it. As usual with these competitions, all the chat is happening behind closed doors. It should be up there so that potential sponsors and TV should be saying, blimey, the European Cup is doing this, that, and the other. But there's no one knows what the heck's going on there. And as usual, private privateering in committee rooms and all that is happening when it should be a debate that the game should have. I think that I don't think it is, or it's certainly COVID didn't help, but I think that the tournament is sagging more than a little because it does not make enough money for the competing teams. Therefore, they do tend to now prioritise their own leagues, except in Ireland. And I think it is a really important what they now do to save this tournament for next season and to really big it up.
Well, you've had a downer on the tournament for a while, Steve. Did this weekend and did these home and away fixtures change that in any sense, that the drama that they created, or is your point wider than that, that you don't feel they're taking the tournament seriously, when I would say that some of the contests would present a counterpoint to that?
Well, look, the thing is the numbers are down. I mean, you know, Alex, and we all know that these days we know exactly how many people read everything that we do. We even know how long they stay on the article with the dwell time. And I don't think the numbers in terms of reading about these games are what they were. But it's taking a snapshot, a personal snapshot. I'm certainly not down on the competition because I watched it from the very start. And it does not have the huge gloss and the sense of a step up that it once had. And that is, like I say, because the top 14 is so successful. you know, people saying, oh, we were wrong to say Montpellier fielded a weak side against Harlequins. Well, they changed 13 players, so one of them wasn't their first team, whichever it was. And they did get through, and good luck to them, but only because Marcus Smith missed a kick. So I think that there's a small rump of teams in France, maybe two or three, who really would love to win it. I think there's ditto in England, maybe only one has got the capability to win it this year. And I do think it needs a complete and utter reset.
So those quarterfinals, Racing 92 will host Sale, La Rochelle against Montpellier, Munster against Toulouse, which will be held at the Aviva Stadium, and not Toman Park because Ed Sheeran has a home gig at Toman Park that weekend, which seems remarkable, frankly, that the Munster can get through and end up having to host Toulouse up in Dublin. But the fourth quarterfinal, which is probably the pick of them, well, for me certainly, Leicester to host Leinster. Stuart, you saw Leicester at the weekend. Leinster are just this beast of a team. How do you see that unfolding?
Leicester are going to have to be on another dimension to anything we've seen from this season. They're an improving English team. Leinster are Leinster could be right at the moment one of the best three or four international sides in the world, which is what Ireland are. They're effectively Ireland, and they play with the cohesion of a club. Sometimes they look even better for their province than they do for their nation. They're going to be very hard to beat. Every time I watch them play, you think, blimey, that was impressive. And you think they've still got a couple more gears to go. The good thing for Leicester is they're not having to play. You know, if what was left of Europe was now a league, Leinster would romp it. But when it's a cup match, you can lose. Odd things happen and you can lose away. And I would say Leicester, if any team can put them under real pressure, it might just be Leicester because of the way they play. Ford is brutal in the attritional nature of keeping teams penned in their corner. And they'll just be hoping Leinster and Sexton just get impatient and try and play in areas where they shouldn't be, and Leicester can put the squeeze on them. They've got a pretty powerful pack. They've got one of those crowds that is the 16th man. So even taking all of that into account, I don't see any other team winning this tournament but Leinster. But it's a knockout game. It's a one-off. Leinster are the best team in Europe by a country mile. But it's the quarterfinal at Welford Road, and you never know.
Alex, I sort of agree with Stuart, except for this. Leicester are a coming team. They're improving. And good luck to Steve Borthwick. He's got them back. It's very short time ago that they were relegation fodder at one stage, if there had been relegation. Now they're coming back, and Leicester is saying, "Look, we're not there yet. We're on our way." And Borthwick is being really, really cautious, as are the players when they talk. Do you know what? I'd like to see Borthwick say, "Look, we're Leicester. If we're that good, if we're becoming that good, well, we should be beating Leinster at home." I'd like them to really go for it, get the crowd stirred up, get the team stirred up. Don't concede that Leinster are favourites, and stick it to them and see what happens. There's nothing to lose. If they should win, then suddenly their revival is up in the sky. So I really hope they talk a good game and go in without caution and give it a blast.
Alex, I just counter that slightly by saying I'm only just getting used to a head coach who says it as it is. It is where Leicester are. Borthwick is being honest. The players are being honest. They don't even use the word pathway and process that much. I'm enjoying the fact that they're just saying, you know, we're just trying to be as good as we can be at the team at the moment. And we've gone through a period of time where there's been so much bull coming out of press conferences and coaches that I'm enjoying Steve Borthwick saying that, for all of what Steve says. And you know, it doesn't matter what Leicester say before Leinster. It's such a massive game. They're going to get themselves up, and the crowd won't need getting up. They're very, Leicester crowd are very pleased with life at the moment, even if Borthwick says we're not the greatest Leicester team ever. They're very happy with where they are.
They beat.
But I think it's a classic English rugby thing to leave yourself an excuse in the pre-match that you can use at the end. It's a quarter-final. It's bloody Leicester Tigers. No excuses.
They beat Clermont over the two legs, 56-27. As you said, Stuart, it's not a vintage Clermont team. How much will they miss Dan Kelly, who went down with what looked like a serious hamstring injury? You'd be surprised if he was fit in a month in time. Yeah. Sorry for those ties on the first weekend of May. And Ollie Chesson was one of five red cards, I think, this weekend, which is a record certainly since Opta started counting in about 2010. Which we'll come on to the red cards thing shortly. But those two players have been massive for Leicester this season.
Yeah, they have. One thing I would say, though, and again, we often hear we're missing so-and-so, we're missing so-and-so. Rugby is an attritional game and you just have to get on with what you've got. It's not as if Leicester got half a team missing, but as it is, Kelly's one of these guys, he's like sticking plaster. He's a very clever player. I think George Ford benefits from having his solidity and basic rugby good sense outside him. Chesham has really developed well. I was impressed with the way he was playing. He caught my eye on Saturday. But again, Leicester have got plenty of cover in that back five, second row, back row. And it's a disappointment for the bloke and for Leicester. But, you know, between now and then, I'm sure Leinster will lose one or two big names as well. And that's just the nature of the game. So, Kelly, yeah, it's a blow. But we just have to move on with that one.
Alex, you're a grand old former prop yourself. I think I would, as a devotee of scrummaging like you, I would pay to watch Ellis Genge against Tide Furlong up front. I think it'll be tremendous. And I think, as far as that goes, the more the refereeing is done by someone who understands the phase and doesn't go for the bullshit, the more that it will favour Furlong. Genge is a very, very clever scrummager. I think Furlong is probably at the moment the better scrummager. So however much they're allowed to scrummage, it will be to the advantage of Leinster if there's a ref who understands it, maybe a French ref. But it's going to be a fantastic battle between those two.
It definitely will. And Steve, just on that subject, actually, at Quinn's on Saturday, Quinns had were camped on Montpellier's line, winning penalty after penalty, resetting scrum. I think it was one yellow card for eight penalties, and in the end they left with no points. What was the sense inside the stadium? Because that was, yes, Marcus Smith missed a kick, but 12 minutes were taken up there on the line, penalty after penalty. There was a sense from watching on television for me that the warning from Mike Adamson didn't come early enough. The yellow card then did eventually come, but then further penalties came afterwards with no other sanction. What was it like inside the Stoop? I can imagine that the place was jumping and expecting points, but also perhaps a bit of amusement about the way that was managed by Mike Adamson.
Well, something told me that the Quinns fans wanted a yellow card, because 12,000 of them were all had their hands up in the air, mimicking the act of flourishing the card, which was interesting. That thing was all fascinating. I watched it again. Watched it again when I came back, Alex, because in my view, let's leave aside Mike Adamson, who I think is really, really struggling. I think that referees now, when a team gets the other team right on their defensive line and bashes, referees would never dare give a penalty to the defending team. They just assume, or that because of the momentum, it can only be the defending team which is offending. Now, in that phase of, I think, eight or nine scrums with three or four lineouts, it was absolutely, blatantly clear that twice Montpellier got the ball, won the ball, honestly, once with a scrum wheel, won the ball and had it. And yet the referee thought, oh, my God, I can't give them an escape. I better give another penalty to Quinns. On the other hand, if the referee is saying that's eight penalties to Quinns, wrongly in my opinion, but he's got to give the card before he did. But then when the card was given, still Quinns didn't quite get the idea that they may not score there. Mm-hmm. As soon as they go wide, Marcus Smith goes over, was called back by a crossing. So I don't think it certainly was a magnificent part of the game, a great sequence, thrilling. Definitely yellow cards possibly should have been shown earlier. On the other hand, I don't think it showed either team in a great light because Quinns seemed to be totally obsessed with the fever. I mean, there was a time when Danny Kerr got the ball and was turned over just because he dived at a huge gang of people to try to score. So I think there was a panic element of that with Quinns, which married to the poor refereeing allowed Montpellier to escape.
Alex, I watched that game closely and I'd sort of narrow it down to two things. Steve makes a very pertinent point about teams in attack, and especially if it's near the end of the game, then they never get penalised. And you see teams, the support man flies off his feet. And you know, if a defender did that, it would be, unless it was Mike Adamson, a yellow card immediately. Attack, you do that, and it's absolutely nothing. So I think Steve, A, makes a very good point about that. But B, if Adamson did think that Montpellier was so persistent, then it was an awful bit of refereeing. And I'd take you back to yellow cards. Yellow cards were brought in not as a lesser piece of foul play, but to cut cynicism out. And in its early days, referees were ordered, we're talking a long time ago here, ordered that if you get first minute of the match, a penalty for offside 5 metres from the try line, the bloke goes straight away. And over the course of the decades, yellow cards have become slightly different. They become less a foul play or something when the ref finally snaps in the end. They are not being used for their original purpose. And it leads to the 2 points Steve has made. Attacks getting away with stuff and defenders, you know, when there's four or five penalties and the ref says final warning, you know, I want to put my arm around the ref and say, don't you understand? It's no final warning. They've beaten you. They've beaten you. And it's as simple as that. The blacks, who Steve knows I have unbridled love for their attacking play, in Richie McCaw and Conrad Smith in their prime, time and again, they would get away with it and the ref would say, come on now, lads, not another one. And that's what happened Saturday, and it was wrong, and it was weak refereeing.
Alex, well, a final point on that, which drives me mad. When the team has been putting the pressure on and the referee wants to speak to the defensive team, the defensive captain says, right, ref, is it okay if I tell my players? The ref says, yeah, go on. He turns his back, goes away. He says, right, boys, there's such some air in here. I bet you he never mentions the referee, and that is... You know, an attacking team, they've got them under pressure, they're hammering away on the line. It is a disgrace that referees ever give the defensive team a chance at a breather, because that is all it is. You should play on. You knew the laws before you came out. Why should the ref be explaining them to you in the middle of the game?
Part of that, Steve, that is linked to the ridiculous palliness that so many referees want to have the players.
Yeah.
They are not their friends. The players, I could tell you firsthand, will smile and they'll be nice. And then behind the ref's back, they'll laugh and say, we pulled one over him that time. Players are trying to get it over the referee. The referee should just call the game. But because he thinks they're all best mates, then everyone could go away, have a cup of tea, a chin bag and a hot cross bun as it's Easter. And all's well in the world. Referees have got to stop thinking that players are their mates. Cut out first names and just get on with it fast.
Absolutely. Just say number six or number eight.
Yeah.
From yellow cards to red cards, as you mentioned, that there were five. That there was Aaron Reed was sent off for sale against Bristol on Friday. I was there. Very similar. He's very different in stature to Ollie Chesham in your game, Stuart, but it was exactly the same. It was a shoulder to the head. Now, there is an argument that the first contact was shoulder to shoulder, but really, I think that's beside the point. He was sent off because he shouldn't have been in the position that he was in. It's led to, as I said, five this weekend, which has made it such a talking point, and anyone who read the Times and the Sunday Times over the last couple of days with extracts from Steve Thompson's book and an interview he gave to the Times magazine on Saturday will surely look at those red cards and think they're an absolute necessity if we're going to try and protect the brains of current players from incidents which, you know, I have no doubt, just like Charlie Yule's when he was sent off for England, he had no intention of executing a challenge that would knock out a player, but he was in the wrong position. He was in a position that made that possible or even likely, and he accepts that he needed to get lower. And that's the message that these red cards are trying to enforce on the game. But it is changing games, and it has led to a lot of them. Maybe start with you, Stuart. How do you reflect on the use of the red card? If you're frustrated with the use of the yellow, do you accept the use of the red as it is at the moment?
No, and I think one of the problems, again, is confusion. A red card is a mark of a sending off, and a sending off is for serious foul play. Now we've got two reasons to be sent off, and it's confusing people. There's serious foul play, and there's the safety and health issue. And I haven't yet got the answer, but I'm thinking about this. And red cards are being used to the same effect for two completely different situations. As you said, you know, if there's malice aforethought, you go straight away. If there's not, you now go straight away. And this is, whether it should happen or not, it's causing consternation and anger within the sport. That's one point, and I think we've got to address that. The second, I think, is we can't have this conversation without bringing professional coaching into it. Charlie Yule's and all the guys who say, yes, we were just too high, they were too high because they're coached to be high. Mm-hmm. You know, you are not coached to tackle around the waist. You're coached to go, so often the two man in. I saw a double, I think it was the Racing game yesterday afternoon. There was quite clearly a double sending off, but the referee sort of chickened out of doing it because one guy pinballed off the one shoulder onto the other. It's all shoulders. It's there to jolt them. It's to stop them being able to get the ball away, and it is coached. And we have to understand now that if we're going to get to it, it's not changing habits on the pitch. It's changing habits on the training ground. And that's where, right now, it's not happening.
On your point there, Stuart, about red cards for two different things, last week we had the brief fullback Axel Müller being sent off for an horrific assault, late, high, dangerous. We also had Guy Porter sent off for nothing,
yeah,
really, a collision off the ball in which neither player was looking, and yet the on-field sanction was the same. And all, I think, remarkably, the off-field sanction wasn't that different either. I think it was only a two-week difference in suspension, wasn't it?
The ludicrous nutter from Brieve got 5 weeks, and the completely innocent Porter got 3 weeks.
So that's
a two-week gap.
So that's another issue that World Rugby wants to use sanctions as a way of changing player behaviour, as they call it on the field, i.e. get them to tackle lower. But the sanction for the accidental incident is not that much less than the sanction for the yeah, premeditated horrific incident.
Steve, did they not halve both of them? So the crazy Brieve fullback, yeah, got a 10-weeker reduced to 5, and a Leicester bloke got 6-3. And
no, they didn't have it because
they're looking, aren't they, at foul play and safety and health from the same set of glasses. And I
don't forget, the reason why Porter almost got as much is because he actually said, no, we don't accept it was a red card.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I think that's unfair, because players are now who are probably innocent are having to say, look, if we, in the current febrile situation, I'm going to get done anyway, so I might as well admit something I didn't do. But look, then, first of all, let's go back to Steve Thompson. Steve Thompson is absolutely lovely bloke. I really used to like the guy. I really used to rate him. I mean, I'd have him up there with Pete Wheeler and, I don't know, possibly Jamie George as the greatest hooker I've seen in an England kit. And we've all, I think, at least many of the viewers and certainly some of us in the studio, have endured dementia in our elders, family, etc. And to have that early in your life, and also got Michael Lippmann, Alex Popham, all the afflicted, is just deplorable. I'm not saying that I think the outpourings of this of their lawyer are helping at all, but I think one of the things in rugby is we're going to have to put up and grit our teeth with Porter incidents. The guy was running along and there's a totally accidental collision. Fritz Lee then started bleeding and the ref saw that. I think that if it had been Porter who started bleeding, Fritz Lee would have been sent off. It was a complete nothing. Now, look, we're going to have to suck it up, I think, until the balance comes back, because the game has to be seen to be as protective as possible. Now, if only all the authorities would really get their act together and say, look, lads, you don't have to send anyone off just because there's a collision. That's not what we're asking. Let's bloody sort ourselves out, sort out the protocols, and not panic. At the moment, the game is in panic stations.
Would it help, gents, if one, you know, some teams are worse than others, and after a while, after three sending off for one of these swinging shoulders, different, that's malicious. One of these sort of strong shoulders, which is illegal anyway, or head on head, you know, the player would get for a health and safety card, an automatic week, no more. But if you send off the pitch, that's a punishment anyway. It's a very different thing what you then do with the serious foul play situation. Mm. But shouldn't we be looking at the... I don't know. It's just off the top of my head. I don't know. Is there any club, Alex, Steve, that has got a far worse record? And shouldn't the authorities be saying to Club A, if they've had five blokes sent off, not for serious foul play, but for sort of head collisions, they're calling the coaches up and saying... there's something seriously wrong with the culture at your club. But until we differentiate between foul play and health and safety, I just don't think... I think we're operating in an utter fog of stupidity.
Tolu Lahti was sent off for Stade Francais at the weekend, after which Gonzalo Quesada said, it's my fault, I should never have picked him. I'm just trying to find the quote here. After long debate, I gave in for him to play. Tolu did what he did during all the last matches he played. Silly mistakes, cards. It's up to me to be responsible for that. So basically, there was a track record of that kind of action from Tolu Lahti, and they kept picking him and he got sent off. And what the coach is saying is that it's his fault, his responsibility. He should never have picked him because he should be coaching the change. As you said, it comes from coaching attitudes as well as anything else. Next on the Ruck, we'll have a look at the success or otherwise of English clubs in Europe, both in the Champions Cup but also in the Challenge, which is dominated by Premiership teams.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crossroads. Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
We've looked a lot at various talking points from the Champions Cup. One of Sale or Bristol had to go through it. It was Sale. They're now travelling to Paris to face Racing. And we've spoken about Leicester hosting Leinster. That's two English teams in the quarterfinals of the top competition. In the Challenge Cup, the Premiership is better represented with London Irish travelling to Toulon, Wasps travelling to Edinburgh, and the Gloucester playing Saracens with Lyon against Glasgow as the fourth quarterfinal. What does that say about the Premiership? And we have this conversation annually, but are two English clubs in the quarterfinals of the Champions Cup, is that about representative of the league and the salary cap and the recruitment and the standard of teams? And what does it say about the Challenge Cup that actually is quite a strong representation?
Well, that is indicative of the current situation, Alex. Just to have two teams in it. And don't forget that in the years when Saracens were in it and dominating it, we all used to say, well, blimey, take away Saracens and what have they got there? So I think it is representative. And I think English clubs should aim to have more. It is not a vintage. It's been some great games in the tournament, in the Premiership, but not possibly of the highest class. And now it's up to Leinster and Sale. I just got this sneaky feeling that the Racing Sale game is not remotely as assured a result as people think. I think Sale have got a fighting chance there, but I just think that I can't see anyone else really in the division who could exist in the quarterfinals or after Stuart in the semi-finals.
I think French have got two in the lesser tournament and four in the big one. We've got four in the lesser and two in the big one. And that, as Steve says, is absolutely indicative of where this is right now. And it's not just, it's very easy to say, oh yeah, it's the wage cap. But Jonesy makes a point well there about Sale and for 1 year Exeter. Outside of them, you know, England was doing nothing. We were getting thumped. And frankly, to have two in the quarterfinal is not that different to how we English clubs have been for quite some time. The French have been dominant. I think at the moment, the quality of Premiership rugby isn't as good as the excitement, but the excitement levels are rising. The attempt to play the game at pace is quickening. And I think you have to go through a change in the game, in the way that the Premiership is, to come out the other side. And sometimes you have to be patient. And as long as the European Champions Cup is still there in 2 or 3 years, I think we might have a very different scenario, despite the money factor. I think young English players come through, can change the culture. It can make teams tighter. And I think the way we play will make a difference. But for the moment, France have the players. They have the squad. I mean, we saw that. If Montpellier told us one thing, it's about squad. Harlequins couldn't have won by 14 points at home and then gone there with 12 changes to their team and had a hope.
No, true.
Montpellier didn't, and that's a big thing. And again, you know, yesterday, Stade Racing, I looked at the Racing bench, and they had Babini, who's a really fine hooker. They had Trevor Nyakane and they had Eddie Benarous. I mean, that's high-class international front row.
That's bomb squad stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's different level. That's a different level. And that is where the finances do come into play because of the, not the best 15 or so, but just the sheer depth of squad.
Steve, Saracens haven't... you've been quite open in the fact that the Challenge Cup has not been a priority for them this season. They're in it because they're back in the top flight this season. Yet they've made the quarters, going away to Gloucester. Do you think it's their tournament to go and win?
I do. They're still not flat out. They still haven't fielded their full side. I think they're shuffling the... I think what they've been doing, Alex, is they've been trying to work out who is going to go into the spaces that they have in the team, i.e. number nine, the new skeleton, the new Wigglesworth at scrum half. I think that's what they're sorting. Yesterday, I was really struck by it. There was a very poor crowd at Saracens. I think that they said that was because the match was arranged so late. But I thought Cardiff put up a good show. I thought it was a good game. What struck me was that they got some young forwards who were really, really coming through. I think Dom Morris is also accelerating in his career. Max Malins was just blissful to watch. And also, I don't want to start an old debate here with my colleague, the fly half, but Owen Farrell just brings something to a team, a level of organisation and steel. And the way he operated with quick ball to keep the moves going and to vary them until Sarri scored just reminds you that he is by no means a negligible player in attack. So, look, the other thing is Gloucester. I mean, what a popular trophy winner they would be if they managed to win the Challenge Cup. So that's a great tie. But I do fancy Sarri's.
Steve, I've got to play devil's advocate here. In the last few years of playing for England, how often have you written about the level of organisation and skill that Owen Farrell has brought to Eddie Jones's England team? I don't remember once. I remember us saying, it's not happening there. We've got a fly half who's following the instructions of his coach and is inflexible. I don't recall steel or organisation.
Well, that's because the whole of the rest of it wasn't happening. I mean, you can't go through the attacking options when you haven't got any.
Elsewhere, just a word on London Irish. They're heading to Toulon, who are not the force they were, whereas Irish are not dissimilar in to Saracens that you just described, Steve, in the sense of they've got a crop of young players who are really starting to flourish, some of whom have trained with England, and Ollie Hassel-Collins, a Tom Parton. They've got Paddy Jackson, who hasn't missed a Premiership game in 2 years, who can run the show at 10. They're an exciting young team, really starting to sort of bubble over, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And by the way, can you give me a list of people who haven't trained with England?
Yeah, well, that's true.
Do you know what? I think Toulon are there for the taking. Now, London Irish, obviously, this season, their status in the Premiership is very important. Leaving aside the lack of relegation, they don't want to be at the bottom, but they've sorted that. I think they've got the team to go to Toulon and win that game. No question. Toulon are airy fairy. They're not quite sure what they're at. And I think London Irish have got a great chance. I think they've got a lot of talent. I think Curtis Rona is one of the best outside backs I've seen this season. And I think they've got a great chance.
Coming up next on The Ruck, we will have a look at the round four of the Women's Six Nations and round off the pod with our god, goddess, or potentially Mark Evans' devil of the week. Coming up this weekend is round four of the Women's Six Nations. Wales host France on Friday night, Italy play Scotland on Saturday, and England play Ireland at midday on Sunday. England and France are currently top of the table with three wins from three. Steve, you have not only followed it closely, but you're very heavily involved in the women's game. You've set up the Iron Maidens at Maidenhead this season, and wrote a lovely piece about it in the Sunday Times, and just talk to us about that process, but also about the girls that you're coaching there and how they sort of see themselves in this England women's team and the bond that exists between the two.
There is a bond. The girls are very young. They only go up to 15. But Maud Muir, front rower, is only 20, came to be our coach this year and has been absolutely wonderful. And she's got this magical Piper thing about her. So the girls have been going to games with their parents or in groups and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, poor old Maud, she's got to do about 50 selfies after every game. But it is definitely inspiring them. And they're watching the games on TV, which they didn't used to. So Six Nations is very big down their way. And it's a very big match this weekend, I think. There's three games, Wales, France, Italy, Scotland, England, Ireland. The big game in the context of making this tournament competitive is Wales and France. Wales are improving. They're becoming tenacious. Nothing great yet, but and France probably not at their best. Now, we can't have too many 50-0, 60-0s, Alex. And you just hope for the sake of the tournament that Wales can give France on Friday evening a proper game and maybe try and keep the score down, possibly even threaten to win it. Italy, Scotland, again, it should be reasonably easy. England, Ireland, I'm afraid. I can't see Ireland really with the greatest will in the world doing much there. So what the tournament needs is closer games and possibly Wales and France. We could see a close one there.
I'd urge anyone to go and read Steve's piece, but Steve, just tell us what it was like. I mean, what made you decide to set up a girls' team? What's the process been like? How rewarding has it been for you to be involved in, but also for the girls who have maybe found a sport that they weren't playing before?
Yeah, there's ups and downs. When you get come back from Leicester from Exeter on the last train, which is delayed hours after hours, you get in at 3 o'clock and you've got to get up in 4 hours' time to take the session. That's not so good. But I've always thought, Alex, your lads play football and mine have always played rugby. And I always thought that all the kids... deserve a chance to have what we have and something with team spirit and sport. But the girls never had that chance with rugby. And the three of us in the studio and we've made such friendships with rugby, had such great times, you know, as journalists or even before we were, or, you know, and The girls love it, and they've wiped what they have done is wiped away the final thing about, oh, the girls, you know, I was worried about them when they went into contact and someone smashed them. They just get up and get on with it like the boys do, and that's been very rewarding. It's very time consuming, and happily next year we've got something which means I'll get all the glory and do none of the work. But it's been great. I've really loved it. The girls have been fantastic. I miss them now the season's over. And any listeners there with girls, with daughters, send them along. If it's a good club, they'll take great care of them. They won't move on too quick. They'll do the contact properly. And in the end, they'll love it.
You talked about this Wales-France game being important for the context of the competition. It's really, we're really just everything's building towards France, England on the last weekend, isn't it? Is that the best structure for women's Six Nations, that we're waiting on England, on the winner of England, France, to see who wins the championship, when there are teams like Spain who are super competitive in Europe?
I would have thought, I mean, look, it's very, very politically charged, this, but, you know, I've always thought that the top two teams are England and France, which they are. I think they should be joined by the third best team. In other words, the third best team this year. And I think they should play each other home and away. That gives each team the same number of games. They should play each other home and away in a first division. And that the likes of Spain and maybe even Kazakhstan or something like that could come into the a second division, and then there'd be promotion and relegation. The bottom team of the top three and the top team in the bottom five would then would then interchange. People will go mad about that, but it doesn't do an awful lot of good, as I say, when you have 50-point defeats. If they can really get Wales, Scotland and Ireland on a fast track so that in 2 years' time they're able to win at home, then that's something different. But at the moment, it's slightly shaky. I mean, Wales put on a much improved performance against England, but still conceded 55 points. So they're not out of the wood yet in the Women's Six Nations.
I think it's a great opportunity, Alex, for Rugby Union to understand that it made a bit of a mess with its sort of closed-door policy with the men. Women's rugby is so much newer. It seems the most appalling shame if they just close the door on teams like Spain. I think Steve's absolutely right. If you turn around and say, what is your justification for not having promotion and relegation? I would love to hear what it is. I would love to hear what it is. It's not 70,000 people in Cardiff at the moment. Let's hope we get there one day. You know, it's not the old tradition. There is no old tradition. There is no 70,000 crowd. All there is vested interest keeping others out. So I hope that women listen to what Steve, the women's game, go along with what Jonesy said, and we have a fluidity to it.
Sure.
Right, Jones, we need to wrap up this episode, episode 31 of the season, remarkably, with our god or goddess of the week. Who'd like to go first? I can't see any hands. Steve?
I got one.
Stuart, you go first.
I cannot believe we've gone through an entire episode of The Ruck without mentioning Ulster versus Toulouse. I got home from Leicester, had a sandwich and a glass of milk and settled down to watch this game. And what a cracking match it was. Ulster are a fine team. I feel for them being knocked out. But my God of the week was a Toulouse player who, by his standards, was terrible. Antoine Dupont, in the Six Nations, if he doesn't have a wonder game, people say he's off form. He really was off form for Toulouse. He was throwing some scatty old passes. He was getting caught in possession. He was second judgment on things. And in the end, they brought on another scrum half. He shifted to fly half. Entomac moved to centre, so they had the two of them just one out. This bloke, who's done absolutely nothing except play 70% below his standard, standing at fly half, gets the ball, sprints straight through what had looked like an Ulster brick wall to turn the game and win it for Toulouse. That's what great players can do. They can play like drains and then just with a flick of the switch, win you the game. It was an amazing for the stone-faced man. Brilliant.
That's a good one. Alex, I considered a devil, which case it would be Olivier Azam. I savaged Montpellier for their selection policy, and I've got an evil, semi-threatening tweet from the great Ollie Azam, so much so that I'm thinking of moving house and changing my phone number. But I'm not going to go for Ollie because I think deep down we always got on, at least I hope we still do. My God of the week is Zach Mercer. A man who eventually had the guts to say, look, this Eddie idiot is never going to pick me. I'll go away and improve my career while he's there. He came up against Alex Dombrandt on Saturday, and what a great confrontation that was between the two. Mercer only came on in the second half, but you saw the incredible contrast between the two number eights. Alex is a very, very powerful, by no means slow, very clever player. Mercer has got another, it's got the edge in terms of pace, running elusiveness and footballing ability. And it was a great contrast, but I thought Zach Mercer looked an international number eight in the key stages of that game. And I think, as the Times said this morning, there'll be a massive loud knocking on his door when he comes to the end in Montpellier and comes back to the English game.
I think those are two outstanding nominations. I had Dupont noted down as someone I would have nominated. So I'm pleased that we got to Toulouse Ulster and that and he got a nomination. Zach Mercer, certainly from what I saw when he came on and in the first leg of that tie has taken his game to another level, as Alex Lazowski did when he went over there last year. Really benefited from that experience. I spent a lot of time watching that Harlequins game thinking I have to give it to Marcus Smith for the try that that Harlequin scored to kind of launch this wonderful comeback, only for him to scuff it at the end. But I still think I'd like to nominate that moment, if that's even possible. The way that they pieced that score together from Danny Kerr's athletic agility to keep the ball in to that moment of magic from Marcus. So although he blotted his copybook at the end, maybe I need to shift it to Danny Kerr for making it all possible at the start. But as moments go of high class rugby, that was right up there. And as Alan Dimmock pointed out to me on text over the weekend, it was on Channel 4. You know, it was available to more eyeballs, more rugby fans than would otherwise have been the case. And if we can keep delivering games and moments like that on free to air and attracting more people, then it can only be a good thing for the game, I'd say.
Yeah. I tell you what, you could have based the whole of the rec on that one glorious try. It really was glorious.
And yeah.
Channel 4 is another good point, Alex. It was I would have thought that would be a great game to show to people who were semi-committed towards rugby.
I think it was a great god as well, because you know, if we'd have called them heroes have feet of clay, and quite literally. In the 76th minute, poor old Marcus came out with a clay-footed kick. So, go on, go for him.
Brilliant. Good metaphors there, blimey.
Gents, thank you for joining me. This is episode 31, signing off. We'll be back next week. Lots of Premiership, Women's Six Nations. Enjoy your rugby week, and we'll see you on Monday. Please like and subscribe and follow us wherever you get your pods. Thanks very much.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional, unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.